this college student, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and he started going on walks, and his name's Nick Jackson in Beaverbrook, and started making babies and figured out what he was going to do with his life, and became part of this community. And so thanks for making this connection, and fun to be collaborating together. And let's see, I'm going to have to, I hope it didn't, there we go. So I'm really glad you're here today talking about how to practice the way of Jesus. Lisa and I live in San Francisco, and we've been married now for 25 and a half years. We've got 3 young adult kids, and they all go to San Francisco State. Our daughter Haley, who's a senior, Noah, who's kind of also a senior, and then our youngest is Isaiah. I call him Spanky. And he's a sophomore. If those guys look tall, it's because they actually are. I'm 6 feet, and they make me look like a very tiny little man. One of them's 6'7", the other's about 6'4". And big guys. We moved to San Francisco when the kids were 1, 2, and 3, and we wanted to start a new faith community in the neighborhood we moved to called the Mission District, that maybe some of you are familiar with. And I was really interested in what would it look like to create a new church community where we really took seriously what it means to follow the way of Jesus. So we spent a few years trying to get together kind of apartment-based faith communities. Eventually, we started an organization to support our work doing this called Reimagine. And one way we like to say it is we try and help each other work on how to put the teachings of Christ into everyday life, into practice in everyday life. And as you already heard, I write on these topics, and actually Lisa and I have been writing together recently. We just had a book come out about 4 months ago on family life. How do you follow Jesus as a family? It's called Belonging and Becoming It. I brought a few copies of the books along in case you're interested. Lisa will be back at the table afterwards. But I wanted to give you a little bit of an origin story about how I got turned on to experiments in following Jesus. When we moved to San Francisco, if I let people know that I was a pastor or a Christian, I would say about 98% of the responses I got back from people were negative. And many of them were hostile. And sometimes my neighbors would remind me, hey, you know, people who say they're Christians, they're responsible for slavery in America. They use the Bible to justify race-related slavery. There were all those religious wars in Europe. Lisa and I were just in France doing some work last month, and very, very few people in France are religious because of so many religious wars that happen in their country. Inquisitions, marginalizing certain groups of people, the reputation of a lot of us who are Christians is that we're judgmental. And that kind of broke my heart to think, why is it that there's that gap between the person we know of as Christ and then the reputation of the average Christian in Western society? And one guy put it to me very succinctly. I'd gotten to know a guy that I met on the bus, and he happened to be a tattoo artist, so I went to work with him one day. And the guy under the needle, he was getting a back piece, this full back piece of a businessman getting his head blown off. And so the bits of brain are flying everywhere. And the guy under the needle, we were talking about kind of spiritual things, and he said it so succinctly, and I'll share with you the PG-13 version of what he actually said that day. But he said, you know, Jesus is cool, it's just that they messed with Jesus. You know, Christianity was at its best when it was this secret, hidden, revolutionary way of love. And he had had enough exposure with Christianity to know that in the first century, to become a follower of Jesus meant that you became sort of an enemy of the Roman Empire. You were part of an alternative society where you welcomed orphans and widows, and you really lived in a new way. And in fact, Aristides in the second century, he was a historian who wasn't a Christian, but he noted what the Christians of his time were like, and he said, Christians, they never fail to help one another. If they see somebody who doesn't have food, they will give them their own food. If they see that somebody doesn't have a place to live, they welcome them into their homes. And then Aristides said, this is a new kind of human being. There is something divine in them. So a question that I started asking myself, and then a group of my friends, we started asking together, is are we experiencing the kind of transformation that we hoped for? Or I would say also the kind of transformation that's promised by the gospel. Because what you see in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John in the scriptures is, and through the book of Acts, is every time someone has an encounter with Jesus, they're changed. They learn to live in a new way. And I think it had to do with the kind of message that Jesus proclaimed, where his message was about life in the here and now. There's a new way to see the world. There's a new way to act based on what's real and what's true. So if my conclusion, I don't know if you would agree with me or not, but my conclusion is I don't think we're experiencing the level of transformation that's promised by the gospel. There's something more for us, something better than what we're currently experiencing. And so my question became, well, are the approaches typically taken to formation or discipleship, are approaches working? So when I thought about how I learned to be a Christian and what I think are the major characteristics of, we'll call it 20th century Christianity, I think there was three things that distinguished how we tended to see discipleship in the past. That we, if we want to see better results in our lives, more healing, depth, and power and love in our lives, then we might have to switch out some of these things. So first, how I learned to be a disciple, and how most people learn to be a disciple in the 20th century, was individualistic. It's about me and my relationship with God through Jesus. And that goes against kind of the communal nature of who we are as human beings. It's not just about me. It's about all of us. This is why in the Lord's Prayer, it doesn't say, give me my daily bread, am I right? It says, give us, lead us not into temptation, that we don't learn to walk with God as isolated, idiosyncratic beings, that it has to be communal. Second, I think many of us who lived in the 20th century, our path of discipleship tended to be information-driven. If I know enough about the Bible, if I listen to enough good sermons or talks, if I really nerd out and read books, somehow that information is going to magically transform me. Are you familiar with this? I see a lot of heads nodding here. Okay, so if this were true, then people who'd been in church for 20, 30, 40 years would be the most loving Christ-like people that you've ever met. Sometimes that's true, but because of the giggles throughout the room, I know that you know people who went on this information path for a long time, and it didn't result in deep transformation, in greater love and power in their lives. So information's not enough. Now, to be fair, there was a time 450 years ago when information was really scarce. The Bible was not written, was not being, it was hard to get a copy of it. It had to be handwritten by monks and passed on to other people. Very few people were literate, and so you needed a trained professional to read the Bible to you because you couldn't get access to it and you didn't know how to read it, right? Well, times have changed. I'm looking around the room. This looks like a pretty smart group, and I'm guessing that most of us can read. And Gutenberg and his printing press, that already happened. So we have access to information. In fact, I have more access. I don't know whose phone this is, but there's more information that I can get on this phone than any human being could possibly access even 15 years ago. So information is not scarce anymore. So we need something more than just information. We get this magazine at our house called Real Simple. Anybody get that magazine? And I know this is weird for a guy, but I whip these monthly women's magazines, and not all of it relates to me, but some of it does, you know. Like, and I'll notice, even in a monthly magazine like that, there's an article on how to forgive, steps you can take to be grateful. Am I right? Good dietary practices like less carbs and sugar, more whole foods and vegetables, right? Good stuff about life. So what I think ends up happening because of all the access of information we have is we kind of know what we could do and maybe what we should do to live better than we do. Am I right? I sometimes feel like I'm walking around with all these shoulds on my shoulders about things I could be doing to live better. And I don't really need more information or more ideas. I just need to get busy doing maybe just one or two of those things that I know would be good, right? Third, the way discipleship has tended to be in the 20th century is disconnected, or I would dare say dishonest, about real life. I think for some reason when we gather as a worshiping community, the tendency is, I don't think we can blame anybody for this, maybe it's just human nature, is we want to show our best selves to each other. I put on cologne today before I came, I showered. You guys saw me the other day, I had like a scruffy gray beard. I wanted to look my best, right, when I'm with you. And sometimes when that tendency is that we're not really sharing with each other the real struggles in our lives, there's a tendency to cover those things up and want to present the best. But in order for us to experience real transformation in our lives, we have to be able to get real with each other about the real struggles of our lives, where we really live. So in contrast to this, how did Jesus teach his disciples to live this kind of life? First, it was in community. Jesus gets up this group. In Greek, it's the Talmudim. Or in Hebrew, it's the Talmudim. This group of people going on a journey together. So they're working out what means disciples to be disciple group. Second, Jesus invites them into this community. He is giving information, but he's also inviting his disciples into action and practices. It's life on life. So they're seeing where he lives and how he practices. So the gospel writers sometimes note this. Early in the morning, while it's still dark, Jesus got up, went to a lonely place where he prayed. So they could see Jesus doing things. And then Jesus would invite them onto these adventures. Sometimes, often most of the time, before they really understood what he was asking them to do. He put them in impossible situations. Hey, we've got 10,000 people here out in the middle of nowhere. I bet they're hungry. Why don't you guys give them something to eat? And the disciples are like, I don't know. What are we going to do? And so they were overwhelmed. He threw them in the deep end of the pool just to see what would happen. And that's how they learned. They learned through making mistakes. He sent them out to proclaim the good news of the kingdom and heal the sick and cast out demons. And the people they went to were frustrated, and they even complained to Jesus, hey, your disciples, they can't do what you do. Look at my son here. They couldn't help him. And so that's when the learning took place. And disciples had to say, hey, Jesus, why couldn't we do this? And he said, well, this situation, it only gets fixed through prayer and fasting. So they needed to fail in order to learn. Third, I think Jesus spoke with an honesty about real life. So if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, it's about the real stuff of our lives. Anybody in the room here sometimes worry or feel anxious? All right, Jesus wrote about that in the Sermon on the Mount, or talked about that in that sermon. Anybody struggle to get along with, like, in-laws or brother-in-law, sister-in-law, or relatives? Okay, you got an awesome. One hand went up. I'm amazed. Anybody else struggle to get along with family?
My in-laws are sitting right there.
Okay. So you're going to have to be dishonest.
No,
nope,
because I don't.
So there's stuff in the Sermon on the Mount about what to do when you don't get along with your relatives. And Jesus says, go be reconciled. Don't even come to church and sing worship songs until you've spent some time trying to get right with your brother or your sister. Right? So it's very practical. So I was mentored by, fortunate to be mentored by a guy almost 20 years ago named Dallas Willard. He was a USC professor of philosophy. And Willard would talk about the availability of life with God. And he had a very eloquent way of talking about the teachings of Jesus. But he would come up to San Francisco and be with our little group. And I would say, Dallas, if it's possible for us to really learn to live in the way of Jesus, well, how would you organize a church or a group of people to actually do that? Like, the way you talk is great about this, but how would we actually do it? And in a deceptively simple way, he said, well, I think a group of people should look at what Jesus did, what he taught his disciples to do, and then try to do those things. And I was thinking, duh, that sounds like a good idea to me. Like, when I first became a Christian, that's one thing that occurred to me as I was reading the Gospels. Let's try to do these things. And then somehow we end up doing other things instead of that thing. Right? I don't know how it ended up. But so some friends and I decided to get together and really go for it with this. So the first thing we did, I didn't tell you guys this, but it was a couple of pastors from Concord, actually. Over a summer, we read through the book of Luke, and we noted every place where Jesus told his disciples to do something. And so we had a list of, I don't know, 25, 30 different things that could be good experiments to try. And then we're like, well, which one do we start with? There's so many things we could experiment with. And we were a young, ambitious group, and we thought, well, let's go hardcore here. This is one of the things that Jesus told his disciples to do. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. One of the great teachings of the church that we practice together, right? You see this happening all the time? Maybe, maybe not. Well, one guy in the group said, well, didn't Jesus say that just to the rich young ruler? And I said, well, no, this is from Luke 12, where Jesus is talking about living a life of abundance in God's provision. And he just said it. Here's how to be a disciple. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Well, did Jesus really mean that or not? Was he serious about it? Well, it seems like he was, because that's in Luke. The same author wrote the book of Acts. And in the early chapters of Acts, it says, selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone who had need. So apparently the earliest disciples of Jesus thought he was serious about this. Why would Jesus tell his disciples to sell what they had and give the resources to the poor? That could sound like a really hard rule. In order to be a follower of Jesus, you have to sell your possessions and give to the poor. What I want to suggest is that Jesus told his disciples to do that because he knew something about the way life actually works. That we live in a world of abundance and God's care. And so, yes, you could sell your possessions and give those resources to the poor, and you'd still have enough. So what this challenges is the question, do we live in a world of God's abundance, or do we live in a world of scarcity? If we live in a world of scarcity, then I should collect as much money and stuff as possible and keep it from you, because we're in competition, and some of us are not going to have enough, and some of us are going to have enough. And Jesus is challenging that with this instruction. Will you trust him? Well, this seemed to be a pattern all throughout the Gospels. Jesus met this guy, Zach, and he invited himself over to his house. And something happened there, because in the middle of the party, Zach got up and he said, he had that short man complex, so if he lived here, he'd probably be driving a huge truck. And And it seems like he'd been spending his whole life trying to get filled up inside. But in the presence of Jesus, he was like, I've been trying to get filled up in the wrong ways. I've been colluding with the Romans and stealing from my own people to get rich. This isn't working anymore. And he stood up in the middle of the party and he said, I'm going to give away half of what I own, and everybody that I've stolen from as a tax collector, I'm going to pay them 4 times that amount. And in response to Zacchaeus saying this, Jesus says, today salvation's come to this house. I don't think it's because Zacchaeus had to give away money to earn his way to God. That's not how people in this culture thought. What it showed is that Zacchaeus finally came home and learned to trust his Creator again. And so he wasn't living out of that sense of scarcity anymore. John the Baptist, when he proclaimed the gospel, you know that his message was about real life, because people would beg him after he'd said, the kingdom of God is at hand. They would say, John, what should we do then if the kingdom of God is here among us? And one of the things he said is, anyone who has food should share with the person who doesn't. And anyone who has 2 shirts should share with the one who doesn't have a shirt. Like, if you want to live life with God and step into the good news, give your coat away. Share your food. It was a visceral response to what Jesus was proclaiming. So our little group decided that we would call our first experiment, Have Two, Give One. And so we sent out emails to a group of our friends and said, anybody want to get in on this experiment with us? Over the next 8 weeks, a group of us in San Francisco in the East Bay are going to sell or give away half of our possessions. What's your guess about how many people wanted to do this with us? So I'm in, Lisa's in, and then I had a couple other collaborators. So I thought, there's 5 of us, and maybe that'll be all. Like, I'll send out this email, no one will respond to it, but at least the 5 of us are going to do it. Well, 30 people signed up, which suggested to me that maybe we're not taking more courageous risks to follow the way of Jesus, because we haven't had the courage to invite each other to take new steps in our lives. So, in addition to that, there was a couple of churches in Concord that did this as whole congregations. So we had to get to work to figure out how to get rid of our stuff. So we developed a kind of a plan. 1 week, first week it was closed. And I remember the way we did it, everyone went through the process and brought the clothes together. So we had a huge pile of clothes in our living room. People dove into the pile and took selfies with the pile. And then we sat down and talked about the pile. What came up for you as you were going through your closet? And people would say things like, man, I found clothes in my closet that still had the price tags on them. And I bought them a couple of years ago. So I guess I didn't buy those clothes to cover a naked body. I was maybe doing some retail therapy instead. Or I'm addicted to getting a good deal. And so I went through the sale racks at my favorite store. Other people said, man, I think I could wear a different outfit for 2 months before I get through all the clothes in my closet. And so some of our clothes we could sell at places like Buffalo Exchange, and other clothes we just need to donate. Then the next week it was collectibles, like small household items, books. Back then we had DVDs and other things. I had this collection of Hummel figurines. Anybody ever seen these? Maybe your grandma had some. I was born in Germany on a U.S. military base, and my mom always talked about her Hummel collection. And so when I went on a trip to Germany when I was a teenager, I bought up some of these Hummels. Just so you know, that was still a weird thing to do in the 1980s when I was in junior high. Not a normal thing to do. I didn't play with them, okay? I saw dollar signs, because they would go up and they were supposed to go up in value. She bought some for $5. They went up to $50. So if I got in on this, maybe I'd have a lot of money someday. So I found out what a lot of us did during this experiment. most of the stuff that we held on to and thought was so valuable and precious was almost worthless. Nobody wanted our crap. And so why have we been storing it and dusting it off and moving it around and moving boxes from every place we moved to? Why didn't we just let it go? Then we got into some other things. Bicycles, cars. Maybe we got off easy because it was a young group and so nobody had vacation homes yet to figure out what to do with. But partway through, a guy in the group said, you know what, I thought that was going to be really hard. But it turns out it really wasn't that hard. And I'm guessing because we live in such an affluent culture, I can get rid of almost everything I own. And in 6 months, somebody would give me a microwave and somebody else would give me a TV, you know, because they got a new one. And I'd have just as much stuff again. In fact, I'm going to have to resist, now that I got rid of half, collecting it all again, because it's so easy to do. He said, I think that if we're really going to get at what Jesus was inviting us into here, we talk about our money. How much we make, where we spend our money, what our debts are, and how much money we have in our bank accounts. And when he suggested that, the room got really quiet, just like it's gotten really quiet just in telling me about that. And we thought about it for a second. Why would we do that? Well, in the book of Acts, it says they shared with one another. How did they know who needed things and who had stuff to share unless they were open about that stuff? The group agreed, we'll try this. And we sent out a template for a spending plan and some things you could fill in. And the next week we got back together to share this information with each other. And we said, you know, you can give us percentages if you want. Share as much as you're comfortable with. Some people brought sheets and threw them up in the air and everyone could see the exact amounts of their debts and bank accounts and everything. But first person who shared was somebody with a Stanford MBA, worked in tech startups. Somebody I felt like it was okay for me to judge for being a wealthy person. And as she shared, we discovered she gives away 25% of her income. She pays way more taxes than the rest of us in the group, so she's responsible for roads and schools and things like that. She was spending less on her housing and food and other basic things than anybody else in the circle. She had nieces and nephews, so she was putting money away for their education. And we're like, wow, God's entrusted you with a lot of wealth, and you've learned to use it in really wonderful ways. Next person shares, and it's a young couple, and they had this crumpled piece of paper, and they said, this is the first time we really looked carefully at our finances, and $1,000 more a month go out than come in. And we also have about $80,000 in school loans to pay off, and we just found out our first child is on the way. So we have to face some things. And that was the beginning of them learning to kind of learn some kind of financial discipleship, some stewardship stuff. And the third person who went shared with us that she was, for the last 2 years, she'd been putting her groceries on a credit card because after paying rent, there wasn't enough money left over. And quickly, somebody in the group said, hey, I had to work my way out of some consumer debt. I'd love to develop a plan with you. Then a couple said, hey, why don't you come and live with us until you get on your feet financially? And you can just help us with utilities. We got some extra room. And then there was a bit of a story behind what was going on with her. She, during her college time, got in touch with some childhood sexual trauma. And it was so painful to deal with. She had to quit school. And her mind was, like, foggy. And she just got 5 years had gone by working, opening a Pete's Coffee downtown San Francisco. And so the group together said, hey, we want to be good friends to you. But we think that somebody who's trained to walk with somebody in trauma could also be helpful. So we've collected some money, and we're going to pay for you to go to counseling. So what our group thought is, wow, all this like connection and care for one another coming out of this thing we thought was scary to do, that we'd never thought to do before. And that was the beginning of a series of experiments that we helped initiate. And I just kind of, it's become our way, where whenever possible, we look at the teachings of Jesus and say, how does this connect with the pain in our lives? And what's some step we could take to live in the good reality that God invites us into? And it led to all kinds of interesting experiments, sharing meals with homeless folks. And when we found out about the struggles of human trafficking, taking steps together in a group to change some of our lifestyle choices, to stop supporting human trafficking and to care for affected people locally. So a few things that I realized when you take a more experimental, practice-based approach to the gospel. One is, we feel closer when we're taking common action. A lot of the people in that first group didn't really know each other very well. Maybe they knew me, but they didn't know the other people. But we really felt close only after a couple of months. When you're showing each other your clothes and your checking account and taking new risks together, you start feeling close. And for years, I've been trying to get people together in a faith community where that was the deepest hunger many of us felt. Man, I wish I had closer friends. I wish I had real community. And what we would try and do is think, if we just hang out enough and eat enough meals together, go on ski trips, do our leisure time together, we're going to suddenly feel like we have that family we always wanted. And it was never enough. It was like a black hole. But when we started trying to live out of our deepest values together and take new risks, then we really started getting close in profound ways. Second, many of us realized we could take steps that we hadn't been able to take alone. I'm convinced most of us don't have the cojones to do discipleship or see God's answers in our lives all by ourselves. If it's up to you, me to walk out of here and take some new step in my life, I'm not likely to do it. But one, two, a dozen other people, if we make a contract with each other and say, let's take a step together, we're much more likely to follow through on that. I mean, people who go to a spin class or some kind of weight training, they know, you hear these people talk, testifying to this, somebody gets into recovery like AA, like, now that we're doing it together, it's a lot easier than doing it alone. Third, we realize, man, we have a living story to tell. This is my friend Alice, and Alice at the time of this first experiment was the marketing director at a mall in Mountain View. Alice would go to work on Monday morning, and people would do that question around the coffee maker, what did you do over the weekend? And sometimes Alice would say, oh, I went to church yesterday. And when she did, no one ever asked a follow-up question about her weekend. How was it? Don't want to hear about your religious stuff. But Alice got involved and had to give one. She goes to work Monday morning. What'd you do this weekend? Oh, some friends and I, we did a garage sale on Valencia Street in the Mission. We're all trying to sell or give away half of what we own. To learn to live more simply and be more free. And her coworkers like, that sounds amazing. Why are you doing this? And she said, well, we've been looking at the teachings of Jesus, and he invites us into this life where we can be open-handed and generous and content and grateful. And her coworker's like, you got to teach me about this. You got to help me to do this. I'm like, I go to the mall after work on Friday afternoons. I'm so stressed out. And so I just start going into stores and swiping my credit card. And I walk, I have these bags, and I walk into my apartment, and I drop them, and suddenly I feel empty again. I got to know what you're learning about really finding satisfaction. And what I want to suggest is Alice was actually preaching the gospel, not at like a 30,000 foot level, but at a very personal, like where the rubber meets the road level, with her friend from work. So I was looking for a way to describe this. When we get into experiments about practicing the way of Jesus, what are we trying to do here? And what I came up with is, I think what we're trying to do is create a Jesus dojo. Dojo is a Japanese word that means place of the way. And what I'm suggesting is that the way Jesus invited his disciples to follow him is more like a karate studio than a college lecture hall. You got to get up and do some things together. So if you think that's a little too hippy dippy Jesus dojo, then instead you could think community of practice. And so here's a little more formal definition of that, of a community of practice. And incidentally, I think this is the way ardent disciples to Jesus have always been made in every generation. They've gotten in the Jesus dojo together. It's an experiment. If we don't like how our lives are right now, then we've got to try something new. Insanity is doing the same things over and over and expecting different results. So we've got to risk doing something different if we want to see change happen in our lives. Hopefully these experiments are inspired by the life and teachings of Jesus. We have to have an imagination for the kind of life that we're being invited into. So it's been helpful for me to think, what would it look like for Mark Standard? That actually is me, but when my hair was less gray. What would it look like for me to live as Jesus lived? How would I respond when somebody bumps in front of me in line at the stores, or cuts me off in traffic, or says something unkind to me? Like, you can start to think, right, that there's a different way, the way that Jesus walked. That's what we're invited to learn. In which a group of people commit time and energy to a set of practices. It has to get specific to something that we're going to take on or try during the week. In conversation with real needs in our communities and within ourselves. And we're invited to reflect on how these experiences can shape the ongoing rhythms of our lives. After we try something on, Did it help us? Did it work? And if it did, how would we make that a normal part of how we live our lives? Make sense? Why do we need a Jesus dojo or a community of practice? I know this is the second slide of a figurine that I've shown you, but I can assure you I don't have like a weird thing about the porcelain figurines.
Is that a hummer?
It's not a hummer. A couple reasons. One is because Jesus said, life with God is available to us. The kingdom of God is within you and among you. God is here, God cares, and God is on the move in this world, bringing about healing and restoration. And that kind of message, which is the gospel that Jesus proclaimed, demands some kind of response. Okay, how can I join in? What can I do? How can I be woke up to that and step into that? I think this requires us to renew our understanding of Jesus, to see him both as Messiah and Rabbi. And a quick way I like to say this is, as Messiah, he makes life in the kingdom possible. And as Rabbi, he teaches us how to live in God's reality. So he's the one who brings us into the kingdom through his death, burial, and resurrection. But he also is the one who we can see in the Gospels was showing us the way. Live like me. Walk like me. Here's how to do it. And you're going to find the rest and peace that your soul desires. One other thing on this is that as adults, and I'd say students, we learn best through action and reflection. We don't learn just by being talked at. We've got to try something. We need to talk a bit and wrestle through some things. This is why at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, after Jesus shares all that wisdom, he says, everyone who hears these words and puts them into practice is wise. So, I had more I was going to say, but I'm kind of wondering if we could just skip ahead. And I'd like to invite you to try something with me. Are you guys game?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I've got sheets of paper here. Maybe a couple people can help me hand them out. And we've got some pens.